So I'll introduce myself very briefly. I'm Director of Environmental Health for the Cambridge Public Health Department across the river. Cambridge has really been committed for quite a while, even before a lot of the climate change preparedness and vulnerability work began, was very committed going back 20 years or so to sustainability. And a lot of communities that have gotten a bit of a head start were already committed to sustainable planning, but now face a whole array of other issues that are related to climate change, meteorological events. And as the public health person on a citywide task force intending to develop a comprehensive vulnerability assessment and adaptation plan, I guess I'm kind of here to report back on what I'm finding as the lone public health person at that table, some ideas that helped me navigate through the discussions that are happening with people who speak a very different language and use very different methodologies. But I think I'd also comment, if I have a chance, a little bit on some of the ideas that were introduced by other speakers here about mapping and about tools for analysis, and to make the simple comment that it really depends on the community. When you're looking at a dense, already overbuilt community where there's not a lot of new development going on, there is a different set of considerations that aren't really about land use so much. When you're dealing with a community where, for generally for better, it's very integrated across social and economic lines, then the mapping doesn't necessarily have the same role, because you find that it's more important to know individual buildings, literally, and to understand where people who are elderly or who have other limitations and disabilities may in fact live. And that's not something which can be generalized with a map, unfortunately. So here, this is sort of the public health kick, public health overview slide, which was in this presentation because it was originally developed for a group of engineers. And I was, again, the only public health person in that environment too. And so I was trying to make this broader point about public health and why this, none of this is very unfamiliar to us who think about planning and prevention. It's really in the core nature of public health to think about going upstream, to getting better leverage to prevent the kind of consequences of poor environmental or other factors driving disease. To try to use prevention as a tool is something that fits very well with climate change adaptation, of course. Examples of the kinds of kind of upstream thinking that fit into a vulnerability assessment certainly include use of vaccines, generally the notion of safety and prevention. IPM is certainly a good example of determining where is your greatest point of leverage, where can you anticipate issues and prevent the use of potentially harmful agents to try to correct problems late in the game. And precautionary principles, certainly another good example of where environmental issues and public health thinking fit together really well, and we're almost built to think about things like climate change. So it's, again, this is the intro slide for those who are not as familiar with public health, but it's very important, I think, to remind people that although a lot of people think about public health in terms of vaccines and flu and that sort of thing, basically, modern public health emerged out of environmental health, about the idea that the environment itself is driving public health outcomes is really at the founding concept behind public health. So again, the relationship between meteorological events and climate and human health outcomes, not completely new to us. But it's always important to index the word environment because it's one of those words that has gotten well out of control. It means something in every field, I promise you. And in the context, in this discussion and in the context of public health, we are talking about those simple ideas like water, air temperature and air quality, risk of exposure to pathogens through poor sanitation, potential zoonotic disease, vector-borne disease, through vectors and the absence or presence of vector control, indoor air quality and all of its factors, the things which drive poor air quality. And when we talk about meteorological events, obviously air quality becomes a major driver of risk of human health as well. And in general, all of this is lingo for those who aren't familiar with nuclear, radiological, biological, and chemical. And this incorporates things like brownfield sites and the storage of large amounts of chemicals and hazardous materials. These are things which represent point source vulnerabilities and are really part of the environment that poses a potential threat as meteorological events become more extreme. And another broad point that I make when I make my public health pitch to the non-public health people is that a lot of people who have begun to think about this, one of my favorite descriptions, given that we've abandoned the notion of global warming quite correctly, we still have trouble talking in broad analogies about what climate change really is and does, and does this mean it's getting warmer or colder, or what actually does it mean? And I think the most useful way of thinking of it is as a risk multiplier. Essentially, every time you have a vulnerability, which you may or may not have been previously aware of, you're going to stress out every system in place that's capable of responding to those kinds of risks. Even if we're not particularly good at it in one area now, we'll find that we were better than we will be because those stressors, social and public health stressors, are really just waiting to happen. They've already begun to happen. So this is just a little bit of background on the idea of global climate change. Again, we largely can put aside doubt, I think, for the moment. I think pretty much everybody in this room is going to agree, by whatever ratio of human cause versus natural pattern, this is a very significant part of our future. So this is simply some visual description of the kind of change which has occurred in the relatively recent past. Here we're looking at historic data, which shows that even in the 20th century, we are beginning to see these changes in the rate of temperature changes, what's described here, that we did not have to wait until the 21st century to look for data showing that this is in fact happening. But again, I think we largely agree, so let's move on. IPCC was discussed earlier, I think, in one of the presentations, and has been a really important source of consensus information. Here we have a variety of projections. What I think the main point out of this slide is simply the immense variation of prediction that's going on here. The fact that we have very legitimate models that look at a scenario where we have synergistic effects from tundra producing methane, for instance. We have a few wild card factors which drive some of these estimates incredibly high, and that uncertainty, that range of prediction, is an important kind of background fact as people are trying to actually put specifics on plans and where will we be in 30 years versus 60 or 70 years. It just adds to the difficulty of doing that. So here are again some, these are kind of the range of models of global temperature change. Best case by 2100 is 4 degrees global. These numbers sound like they're relatively small changes, but I think one analogy that works really well here is if you think about the impact on a human body of a relatively small change in temperature. If you had 1 degree above your normal temperature, that would be sustainable and you'd easily recover from that. If you're 4 or 5 degrees above your normal temperature, this is potentially life-threatening. And to think about anything above that goes beyond our ability to really recover and to retrieve. So these small temperature changes, of course, are hiding the fact that averages don't indicate that each small change in average reflects an enormous change in extreme, and extremes are what's driving our risk. So rise in winter temperatures, really we have looked at a much more accelerated rising in Arctic regions. And again, extremes are what get to us in terms of our vulnerability as a population. Our health risks are driven by those extremes, and averages don't really tell that story. So one of the things that's really important to consider even within the United States is that not every region is anticipating the same kind of climate change. So a city that's a coastal city in the south or on the west coast may have a very different set of anticipated changes, whether it's in fact drier, hotter weather, or perhaps wetter. Being in the Northeast and working on behalf of people who live in Cambridge and working closely with our partners in Boston and in the region, we're obviously concerned about what changes have occurred in the Northeast. in addition to the added risk of sea level rise, which has already occurred. The general estimate in the Northeast is that we've seen about a foot of sea level rise over the last century, some of which is a result of subsidence of land, but also as a result of actual sea level rise independent of that. And those just simply magnify the effects that will occur when we get a major meteorological events that are much more energetic, higher category storms than we've seen for the most part. We're already beginning to see those. There's also the effect of, since we are talking about coastal communities and how coastal communities are affected by climate change, in areas that rely on the ocean as a big part of the region, as a part of the economy, as a part of the history and the lifestyle of that region, coastal regions are expected to have a disproportionately negative outcome as a result of global ocean temperature rises, that the deep ocean will be less affected, at least in the beginning. So things like the fishing industry, coral reefs, they'll be affected much more quickly. So increases in heaviest, so this is sort of the core slide in terms of us thinking about what we can expect here in the Northeast and what we've already seen. But almost all of the global models look at it's important to consider, this isn't total average rainfall. This is about the frequency of intense rainfall events. And it's more important, frankly, than the average rainfall. And it also sort of comes back to the idea that what really begins to affect us aren't averages. It's extreme occurrences. And when extreme occurrences start occurring in more frequent pattern, we're going to find that our infrastructure, which was designed by people who understood the climate at that time, is just simply not fit. And that goes from everywhere from streets and bridges and tunnels to the power grid, which is designed in different parts of the country to be able to withstand different ground temperatures. That is changing. And so thinking about opportunity, we've talked about the smart grid. It's something we really need to get towards. We may not have much choice. We may have to really redesign our grid relatively soon anyway. So people have talked about the public health impacts from climate change, and I don't want to go over it too much. There are broad categories or buckets that I think capture a good deal of it. There are a lot of uncertainties, of course. The emergence of infectious diseases that we can't possibly anticipate right now, but that where their prevalence in different parts of the world are certainly changing and being pushed by climate change already. But heat emergencies comes right to the top of the list. Of course, it was a reference, I think, to Chicago. These sound like, oh, a handful of people may be affected in this or that case. We've had heat emergencies. It's not that big a deal. The going from what we currently experience to temperatures that are even a small number of degrees higher, but most importantly, for longer periods of time, changes the story, really does change the story when air quality just plummets after several days of higher heat. And the ability to just withstand the burden among people who are elderly or have chronic disease or asthma, obese, diabetes even, are nonlinear. In other words, you get longer heat wave, you're going to start to see consequences that begin to increase in a geometric fashion. Heat waves that now last a few days, Boston doesn't see more plus 90 for more than about 3 or 4 days, but once a year. Some years we don't get that. It's very easy to imagine, based on models that have been worked on quite a bit, that we could be looking at heat waves like that last a couple of weeks, or weeks, more weeks. And again, imagine how that changes air quality. Imagine what that does to people who have respiratory illness already. It also changes the other climate factors that increase the productivity and the efficiency of the growth of plants that produce a lot of pollen is also anticipated. It's already been seen to some extent. And so that also is expected to be a greater burden. So let me make sure I check on time. So some of the other categories of effect on public health, these are not really local issues. These are global public health issues, but they're all part of the what we have to think about. Enteric pathogens that one can become exposed to much more easily as a result of septic floods where the storm and the sewer system are intermixed, or flooding that occurs in such a way that it forces sewage backup into buildings. This already happens in some communities, and it happens to us, but it's likely to occur on a scale that goes well beyond what we've had to deal with in the past. And imagine floodwaters that, you take your pick, it's maybe as a result of heavy precipitation, or it may be the result of a overtopping of our dam system here at the head of the Charles River, so that what you get, in fact, are briny floodwaters, which have a very different kind of impact on the built infrastructure. And imagine that same scenario where you get sewer, combined sewer overflows, so you're now talking about a septic and briny. I mean, you can imagine that the layers of impact differ, really depend on what the scenario is, but they're not good. So another area that we intend to include in our vulnerability assessment is something where we've already seen some change and an escalated risk, which is vector-borne disease, particularly from mosquitoes, although I think I have 5 minutes. Yes. But also ticks as well, Lyme disease from ticks. Although I won't have time to finish all my slides, I thought I'd give a little quick side story about the change of the range of certain mosquitoes that have public health importance. There has been a lot of work already that's looked at Aedes aegypti and its increased range up to Northern California, and the expectation that there will be dengue as one of the diseases that it can carry, and there's anticipation in Northern California that they may have to face that risk. On the East Coast, we have a similar risk from a similar species. It's Aedes albopictus, which is called the tiger mosquito. And it's a global tropical, subtropical species, which has been found now to be migrating further and further north. It's a concern because it's an aggressive daytime human biter, which is a container breeder, meaning that it's found in cities, not in swamp areas. And it's quite capable of carrying a virus which is locally of enormous concern, which is EEE, Eastern Equine Encephalitis. It's a virus which has an enormously high mortality rate among those infected, 40 to 50%. And if you can imagine a combination of a mosquito that is a daytime aggressive biter that's container breeding, that's found in cities, that can carry EEE, we're now talking about people having to deal with a level of panic, people in public health, we haven't seen before. So that's just one concrete example of something that could occur. And of course, emotional and psychological effects. And when we think about that, it's not just the short term, those who are displaced as a result of a major meteorological event, but people who are displaced for a long period of time, who have lost their community, who've lost in short or medium term contact with the people who are their network. Those are the kinds of effects that we think about when we think about social vulnerability as part of our citywide public health vulnerability. So I really don't have very much time left, and I think we want to have some good questions since we put them off to the end. But I just want to skip through a little bit. The scenarios we will be examining in our citywide vulnerability assessment, which is now underway, and we expect to have finished sometime in early, mid next year, are mostly built around flooding, both from storms, sea level overtopping, failure of dam systems, which we rely on holding water back. We have more than one river that we're affected by. These kinds of major flood scenarios have built infrastructure impacts, but on the public health side of things, of course, we're really thinking about healthcare systems and clinics, EMTs and ambulances, their ability to reach people, our ability to communicate to the public that we serve, which is going to be severely affected by the storm itself, loss of cell phone communication, and even simple things like the decision to evacuate, which has, I think, been touched on here, is a really profound question because the cost of evacuation is enormous in terms of human stress, and especially among elders, among people who have pets who may or may not be served by that evacuation. It's sometimes thought as, oh, well, let's do the safe thing. Let's get people out of here. But that is not at all necessarily the safe thing to do, and sometimes it's really the dangerous thing to do. And the other major scenario that's driving the vulnerability assessment that we're doing in Cambridge, of course, is around heat and heat emergencies and what occurs when the power demands of a heat wave trigger power loss and what occurs in terms of people's health and the vulnerability in particular to power loss. There was a discussion about cost, which I think is really a central question. If you don't have, if you have expensive, if you can't afford the money that it takes to keep your place cool, if you maybe don't even have air conditioning, you know, there are many other health consequences that are that could result from that. I think all these presentations are available, and I think maybe I should leave enough time for us to have a broader discussion. But I worry a lot, and I preach a lot when I'm at the table with the non-public health people in our planning process, that they're thinking about the single event that occurs that you immediately plan for, the police fire response, that way of thinking about it. And I'm often pushing back and saying, yes, but it won't stop there. We've got to deal with and plan for the consequences of recovery, which will take weeks and months. And that isn't how you normally think about those kinds of pinpoint events in time. And so here's just a little bit of a visual. I don't have a lot of pictures in my presentation, but here's the Back Bay. That's the Charles River. This particular photo only captures a teeny corner of Cambridge, right where MIT is. But this essentially is a predicted 100-year flood zone. This is already, unfortunately, presumed overtopping. It looks like I better stop.